Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, then this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. This week, I'm delighted to be sharing our very best bits from the Divorce Podcast. These are the episodes that highlight the essence of what the podcast is all about. In this first section, we've gathered clips from episodes that focus on the emotional journey of divorce and separation. So comedian, actor and writer Jessica Fortescue, father, founder and rugby fan Ed Bassett, and husband and wife team James and Claire Davis, aka the Midlife Mentors, each provide a unique look at the emotional side of separation that encapsulates the experience of divorce in their own unique ways.
It took me a long, long time to action that separation because I felt like there was a wall of impossibility around it.
Yeah.
There were family circumstances, his family with ill health and eventually losing a parent. There was financial reasons, but mainly obviously our son. I just thought, I mean, my parents separated when I was in my teens, and you know, I look back retrospectively and think they probably should have done that years before they did as well.
Children of divorced parents say that, don't they? It's just, why did they, you know, the fact that they stayed together for us feels so bad because they'd have been happier had they gone their separate ways. It's really interesting to hear you say that.
And I watched, and I think, again, you know, in retrospect, I watched my parents stay together, together. Way too long. I watched them do this big, long, elongated version of what I felt I was at the beginning of the road of with my partner, where eventually my parents were in separate rooms. They worked in different cities. They had secret new partners. And as that went on over the years, they lived in this... They didn't like each other. It was a horrible... find a bundle of lies and actually I genuinely look back, God, it's hard not to get emotional. I look back at that childhood and think it was the lies and the dislike of each other. It was living in that space with two people who didn't like each other, who weren't there together, who had no physical proximity with each other. I remember seeing them hug once in my life, my parents, and it was a Christmas day drunk, and I remember as a child getting in on the hug and then feeling guilty for decades that I'd wrecked the one hug I'd seen them have. And I didn't want my son growing up with that. And I thought, actually, that was another thing where I thought, I don't want my son to grow up with two people who don't behave like they like each other. I would rather he grew up with two separated parents who were happy. But yeah, he has been the most classy ex I could ever have ever hoped for, and that is above and beyond the number one reason that's made this, from my point of view, a successful separation. And there are lots of things to take into account in terms of the actual physical leaving. And I think one of the main ones is, if you are the person who's doing the leaving and the person who's left doesn't want to be left, I think it's really, really important to take responsibility and ownership for the hurt you are causing that person. And not to brush over it, not to expect them to be fine, even years on. And not to,
you're right.
Not to live
to
with shame
it,
and guilt. It's not about, you know, if you need to be in unbearable pain all the time to do that. That's not what I mean.
What I would do differently in separation or in divorce, I mean, they're two very distinct things, because once you've made the decision to divorce, I think it's quite difficult to pull it back. And, you know, if the question is, what would I do differently in divorce? Well, everything. Where do I start? Right. Everything. I mean, It's you're not prepared for it. It becomes about financial settlements far too quickly. The ability to talk about the children and what's best for them. Yes, it's really is the priority. The finance has to come a lot later. The main thing, and again, I think the ease of divorce would be made a lot clearer if there was a separation of well-being impacts for all people concerned, including where you're going to live, but access to children, and indeed what is best for the children. And thankfully, that was managed reasonably well. But it gets very confused with, you know, and ultimately, I think you should have a letter or you have a statement which says this is the terms of separation and what will happen to the children, including probably how the children are told. I was unfortunate that I wasn't present when they were told about it, which was quite distressing. And then again, these kind of things cause a lot of resentment on both sides because people just don't have any foresight. They don't have skills. They're getting bad advice from people about what needs to happen and emotions are running high. And I really could have benefited from some kind of support and advice from the moment of separation right through to deciding divorce was the best way forward. That I had no understanding of it at all, and it was very difficult to navigate.
It sounds like that whole emotional journey piece was missing. So the bit where you talk about the feelings and the emotions, and then you have some time to acclimatize to a separation before then having to make some of those bigger decisions. And you're right, putting the important stakes in the ground, like the children, and navigating that bit well so that you're building the foundations for a co-parenting relationship.
I think without making excuses, the fact we were over in Singapore, away from family, I think it was probably worse than it would have been in the UK. I think there was an acceleration very quickly, and also I was living in a different city. So it was just incredibly hard. And again, it's not an excuse, but I think it boils back down to before you make a decision to separate, you know, how do you keep your relationship positive? Well, it all boils down to communication, and it boils down to, you know, do you want the same things? I mean, I think it goes back to, I don't believe that marriage, and I don't look at it now like I did 10 years ago, as this sort of infinite relationship sort of concept, much as I'd like to believe that is possible. And I also don't think divorce is the shame, or it warrants the shame that I felt for many years. I think, and one of the ways I would urge people to talk to children, if they have them, is to very much express that it is entirely normal and it's a very positive thing. You know, divorce is not this big, like I think society makes it. Men are embarrassed to talk about it. I think they feel a lot of shame, particularly when they're maybe estranged from family and not living. And again, same applies to women. If their lifestyle has changed dramatically, I think people are terrified of admitting it in some ways. And that shame is not warranted. And one thing we talk a lot about in Blue Mind is encouraging people to see it as just a life event. And yes, it's not great. And I don't think divorce, that frankly, is the issue. I think the issue is, for me and a lot of men,
quite a journey then, and quite an emotional roller coaster by the sound of it. You complete sort of reset and reboot after your first marriage, going into a second one and that not working. That must have been quite hard on your self-confidence at that point.
Yeah, it really was. I think, the reason that I do what I do now is because after my second divorce, I was put on antidepressants. I was very, very low. I piled on the pounds. I didn't look after myself, didn't respect myself at all. So my self-worth and my self-love was non-existent. And it wasn't actually until I found the courage to seek some help and exercise. I know it sounds crazy, but the exercise completely changed my world. So did nutrition. Learning about how to look after myself gave me back some of my self-respect. I was able to come off the antidepressants after about 6 months. And that's when my passion, particularly for helping other women going through a similar thing, really ignited. And that's why I requalified to do what I do now. And it's a beautiful thing that I'm able to do the coaching that I used to do with the stress management and then the ALP, and then add in the physical side of things as well.
Because I think the first thing that's really interesting is helping people like get back in touch with their physicality. I think so many of us actually lose connection to our body. And certainly when we go through something like a separation or divorce as well, like looking after ourselves, you know, self-care can be one of the first things that goes out the window, you know. Mm-hmm. We're stressed, we feel down, we may tend to like comfort eat, comfort drink, the weight piles on, we feel bad about ourselves, and it comes in a self-perpetuating circle. What we found is if you can put people back in touch with their body and just start taking small steps about moving more, and there's lots of research about daily exercise actually changes our neurotransmitters. Yeah, we'll get feel-good endorphins. We'll start to actually lift our moods, feel less anxious, less stressed. Mm-hmm. It's about getting that movement part in and starting to move the body. And that's funny. It seems to then have an effect on thought patterns and brain. So obviously that's one level we want to work, the physical level. Make sure we're nourishing the body in the right way with the right kinds of food, you know, cutting back on the sugars, cutting back on the alcohol, putting in fresh, natural foods. So we're promoting, you know, good gut health. But then on the psychological, emotional level, one thing interesting there was like, you know, recognizing people that, yeah, it's natural to have a grieving process, but also to not spend too long there if they can, to recognize that, yeah, okay, these things are lost. But if you dwell on what you've lost, you're going to drive yourself mad. So actually we talk about switching from obstacle to opportunity thinking. So it's like, okay, this thing's happened and I'm going to grieve the things that I've lost, but what are the opportunities that I have going forward? What's changed for me that I can see a positive way ahead, and starting to switch to a more positive way of thinking? And once you do that, and there are daily exercises, we give people to do that, things like a daily gratitude practice, you actually quite quickly start to change your mindset. And in conjunction with physicality, that can have a very fast effect on kind of turning people around to feel more positive about things and start to build that confidence up. And then the last part, I'd say, is, as Claire said, we get more risk adverse. So it's starting to learn to take small risks that you're comfortable with at first, but are just going to slightly push you out. Like, go and start a new hobby. We let our ego hold us back. You know, if we've never danced, but we think, I always love to dance, but it's like, I don't want to look a fool. Well, guess what? You know, a child, when they go to a dance class, never danced, doesn't worry about looking like a fool.
In this next part, we highlight some of the great episodes that home in on the experience of co-parenting and everything to do with our children during a separation. Clinical psychologist Dr. Angharad Rudkin, director of The Co-Parent Way, Marcy Scholl, divorce parenting expert, speaker and author, Christina McGee, and returning once more, Jessica Fortescue, share their individual insights on parenting from a variety of perspectives.
I think what you just said there about this being a process, I mean, that's one of the things that always strikes me whenever we talk to people going through this. And when I think about my own experience, you have to have the same conversation reframed at various ages and stages with them, because they take on new information, they put things together in their own minds, they retrospectively go back and reinterpret things. And it is an ongoing process. And as much as from an adult perspective, you want to think, my divorce was 10 years ago, I don't really want to think about it anymore, you don't have that luxury when you have children, because you are having to listen to them and help them reinterpret the events over and over again. It's part of your life's narrative after something as big as a divorce, isn't it? It doesn't go away.
No, it really doesn't. And that's your child's childhood. So that's the only childhood they're going to have, is the one where mum and dad divorced. So it really is something that you are going to have to revisit as a parent, even if you've moved on so much yourself and, you know, maybe can't bear to or are quite bored by having to revisit the divorce for your children. Is very important. And like you say, when children get to different ages, they go back and they reevaluate their lives. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, a child's brain is changing massively in those first 24, 25 years of life. So every time they get into a new stage, they almost have to reevaluate life and their understanding of it and what it all means to them. And so as part of that reevaluation, they're going to look back at things that might have happened when they were 3 or 8 and be really thinking about it. So that's why adolescence is a very tricky time anyway, because if there's a lot of reevaluation, there's a lot of figuring out who I am, how come, and if there's a divorce within that, then they're going to want to come back to it and say, well, how come that happened, mum and dad? How come you said that? And how come we did that? So it's having to be aware of that. And it's not children wanting to rub it in or go back over stuff or not noticing or not being interested the first time you tell them. It is about their brain changing they need to reevaluate stuff. And, and we talk about regrieving a lot of the time, you know, that with young people, if they've suffered a loss or a change, they can look as if they're coping with it. And then when they get to starting their own relationship, or they go into their own graduation, or they go into a wedding, that suddenly it comes back, this big loss that they had to deal with. And it's a big process.
I'm noticing it now at the moment because my daughter's 15 and so she's just starting the whole boyfriend thing. And so I think for her, that brings up a lot of stuff about relationships. And I think it's really noticeable that now there's a lot of reinterpretation going on, and it's, you know, having to have those conversations, as you say, again, and help them distance themselves between your relationship and how they form relationships. But I think that whole thing about teaching relationship skills is so vital and so important, because I think that's what helps us as a society move forward en masse, rather than just a couple of people doing it well and what have you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, with our children, they learn mostly by watching and copying us. You know, we can tell them something a billion times, but if we act in a different way, then they're going to act the way we act. And that's a very hard a lesson of parenting, that we've got to be the person we want our children to maybe be or be like. And of course, going through a divorce, you know, that's a massive challenge when it comes to relationship skills, isn't it? Because the degree of negotiation and compromise and generosity and all these things you're having to try and deal with every day is really tricky. And it's, you know, the thing is about parenting is we don't want to be perfect. We absolutely don't want to be perfect. I mean, what kind of children are we bringing up if you know, the perfect parents? But what we want them to see is that when we do make mistakes, these are the ways that you can come out of it: by communication, by, you know, taking some time out, by looking after yourself. So it's not about having to be perfect and never having an argument or a quarrel or a mean thing to say at all, but it's just being able to own that and help our children understand.
You know, you're going to have to co-parent and parent with this person for a while, because your children aren't going anywhere, right? So it's important to provide that stability for your kids. And if you think of it like a bone, right? You break a bone, you break your arm, and if you have a clean break, the arm heals well. If you shatter your arm and there's, like, you know, there's bits of bone everywhere, it's much harder for that bone to heal properly and strongly. It's the same in relationships. You know, we have a responsibility to, fine, we're breaking up, okay, but we have a responsibility to make sure that's a clean break, a well-managed break, a well-structured break, and how we parent and co-parent needs to reflect that too.
Yeah, I'm just going to draw the distinction here. When you say a clean break, we don't mean this in financial terms, because I know that some people will have listened to the podcast where we talk about clean breaks financially. So just to make that
absolutely clear. I'm just children here, parenting here.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's a really nice analogy, Marcy. It kind of brings it to life, doesn't it? The idea of having that very, you know, that break that's easier to heal than, you know, a really messy, horrible kind of jagged one where you've, as you say, you've got splinters that are sort of all over the place. I like that. I mean, what do you see doing, you know, talking to parents as you do and working with them and coaching? You've got to get either one or both of them into the kind of coaching methodology. What do you see as the most common obstacles? What stops people? Because it all sounds very good, doesn't it? You know, it sounds like a bit of a no-brainer, but we know that life's not like that. It's hard. This stuff is hard. Yes, we make it sound easy and simple. We don't make it sound easy. We make it sound simple because we're trying to communicate something. But what stops people from doing this?
Well, knowing about it, definitely, is one thing. Can be cost as well, which is why we've developed the online course to make it much more accessible for people. Mostly it's about not wanting to show up and be vulnerable. And it's a bit of fear around actually having to take responsibility for their actions. Usually by about 10 minutes into the first session, that's gone away. But it's getting parents to realize that actually this is going to help and benefit their kids. When they can see that, then they come.
And I guess as well, there's a bit of a societal barrier in that I don't think we talk very much, do we, about that transition from parent to co-parent. Parenting and co-parenting to me feel like very different roles. And the fact that we have to transition from one to the other doesn't get much attention. We all know that, you know, you have to get divorced, and we all know that you've got to sort finances out, and we know you've got to make arrangements for your children in terms of where they're going to be and how they're going to see each parent. But nobody talks about the mental shift from, you know, being a parent to being a co-parent. And when the relationship breaks down, some of the, I think of it as oil that sort of oils the wheels of the parenting relationship. Some of that is obviously lost. It leaks out because yeah. the love between the two of you isn't there anymore. What do you think that shift is? How do you make the shift from parent to co-parent?
Well, it's hard. You're absolutely right. When we talk about it, we try and help people that they're moving from one shape of system to a different shape of system. So if you think they're going from kind of maybe a circle where they're all in the same kind of unit to a line where, you know, there's a parent at each end and the kids in the middle, but they're still on the same line. They're still part of the same family system. The children still have the same parents. And when you can explain it from the children's perspective, you know, your children, you might be getting divorced and you might not want anything to do with each other, but your children still have you both as parents. So what we work with parents to achieve is to make it more of a business arrangement in many ways, more transactional, much less emotion, taking the emotion out of it, making the interactions, especially if it's difficult, making the interactions very short, very focused, not brutal, still soft and respectful, but with a very clear purpose. So you eliminate any room for emotion to come in. You eliminate any miscellaneous items to come in. And I think when you've been doing that and kind of living that for 12 months, it becomes much easier then to kind of step into that place. And then from that, you know, sometimes we see parents become more allies and maybe they meet as a kind of family unit, but that's not the expectation at all. We don't set out to achieve that utopia.
So I think the other thing that kids sometimes wonder is, if mum and dad can fall out of love and divorce, can that happen to them? Can a parent divorce a child? And I guess that's for younger kids, but it's kind of important, I think, to make that distinction between the love you can have adult to adult and the love between a parent and a child. Is that something you come across, Christina?
Well, I think I would challenge that all kids struggle with that. You know, this idea of divorce calls into question unconditional love for a lot of kids. And so kids do wonder at all ages, you know, if you can stop loving each other, does that mean someday you might stop loving me? You know, what is it that I might do that would create a rift in our relationship? And so I think kids need reassurance that the love that's shared between a parent and a child is a forever kind of love. It's not going to change, and that's different than the love you share as a couple in a marriage relationship. So kids needing to hear things like, you know, it's not your fault is really important. And that's why the why is so critical, because, again, kids start piecing together and creating a context for understanding this experience, this big change in the family. And if we're not having those conversations with them and giving them information and continuing that conversation, then they're left to figure it out on their own. And those reasons, those stories they come up with may or may not be based on fact.
You've done so well in creating an atmosphere where you can make mistakes and it not be a, right, this is serious, we have to go and go to the court to get this sorted out, or we need to get somebody else involved to sort this out. So what you're showing us is that the way that you've gone about the breakup has given you some capital. It's given you a license, both of you, to make mistakes and it not be the end of the world, but to accept the mistakes you make and to expect this is not a perfect world. There is no perfect right way of co-parenting. Post-separation, you have to find your way, but you're able to find your way in an environment of tolerance, and that speaks volumes. I'm in such admiration.
Oh, Thanks.
So I think, genuinely, I didn't create
him,
that.
You know, yep. he's been incredibly classy through, I think, much more painful emotional struggle with it than me. And he's just stayed classy, is the only word I can think of for it, really. Yeah. And there have been moments where it's not been ideal. You know, there have been moments we have fallen out since in the years, you know, over bits where we parent differently. We've got different takes on education, you know, we've got those things I've learned on the hoof. We've had a fallout during a parents' evening that afterwards I've gone, right, we need to do a pre-brief and a debrief before parents' evenings if we're going to go. I had no idea he was going to bring up the things that, you know, and then similarly, but then it was like, well, it's on me. I've been too busy to even think to have a conversation before we're in a room together, actually having a really important thing. Then all his takes are valid, as are mine. We need to meet before, lesson learned, meet beforehand. And present a united front in the room, or at least say in the room in a calm way. Don't sit there being surprised and crying in front of a primary school teacher, for Christ's sake, Jess. You know, like, there have been loads of mistakes. I also don't want to present it as having been entirely idyllic. I think we're also in, compared to other separated couples moving into that house, my son loved sharing a bed with me, still does, and he's 7. Any opportunity, if you're staying at a house where there aren't no beds, he'd be like, we can go, you can do that together, you can cuddle me all night. And I remember thinking, oh, well, it's fine that I haven't built his bed, because he can sleep in with me for a couple of nights. And that, I remember that, his behaviour, like, taking an incredible turn, and me being like, oh, and then thinking, oh God, of course, he hasn't got a room. He's got that. He hasn't got a room. Everything's changing in his life, and he hasn't got a flipping bed. And thinking, oh God, you know, and dropping everything and building the bed, and it all was fine. But that felt like an enormous, like, what were you thinking? I don't know.
For this final section, we've brought together clips from the Divorce Podcast, which best highlight the financial aspects of divorce and separation. So we've got financial planner Louise Oliver, Daniel Copley from Zoopla, Shripali Chowan Tufail from Amicable, legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg, and solicitor extraordinaire David Hodson, OBE, each presenting the important aspects of finances on divorce and separation. Never done any of this, or not being sort of part of the family finances before, I guess that can be quite daunting as a task in itself, because you don't know what you don't know. So is it the case that as a financial planner, you can help people prepare for financial disclosure, for example?
Yes, Kate, we can. And it's really important. And many people really don't like talking about money.
No.
I think that people have their head in the sand and they just get on with it. And they don't want to worry about it. But what we find is, initially, it's quite scary and people are shocked about what their outgoings are. And we often send people back to do their homework again, because they might just roughly work out their outgoings. Mm. And we look at it, and the team here at Piercefield Oliver, and they'll say, they haven't put anything down for, you know, food, or they haven't put anything.
The important thing is to do some prep. Don't bury your head in the sand. Confront that you need to understand the numbers and you need to understand what you've got. What are the common pitfalls that people fall into when planning their finances on divorce or separation? What do you sort of think people forget about or come a cropper with?
Yeah, people do forget to think about the future. They're in the moment. They're thinking, we need to get this sorted. Want to get as clean a break as possible. Most people do anyway. Mm-hmm. And they look at their numbers now. One of the biggest pitfalls is that people don't look into the future. They don't forecast forwards. And inflation, as we know, at the minute especially, can bite. So whatever you need now might be different in the future. So you have to, in my opinion, make an assumption for inflationary pressures as time goes on. You can use a long-term average. Any assumptions that you make have to be reasoned and reasonable. So looking at the long-term average of inflation, for example, is nearer to 3%.
Right.
So you wouldn't necessarily forecast the 8-9%, maybe double digit figures we're heading for at the moment, sadly. So people forget to do that, to think about the longer term. They also forget to think about what might take the train off the track. To give you an example, if you're receiving a spousal maintenance or income for child benefit, that's been awarded as a divorce, then you should look to ensure the person that's paying the maintenance, because if they're paying the maintenance from their income, which is very likely, and they die, or they're critically ill and they can't work, chances are the maintenance payment will fail. So Daniel, to ensure...
Maybe you can explain, what are the different options? How can people own property together?
Well, there are two main ways that couples can own a property together, and that's as joint tenants or tenants in common. If you're joint tenants, you jointly own the whole property, you split the property and any proceeds you earn from it 50-50 when you come to sell. If one of you wishes to remain in the property, they'll need to buy out the other one's 50% share. And joint tenancy is great if you're both putting in the same amount of deposit and splitting the mortgage and the bills equally. But if one of you feels they've contributed more than the other, it can lead to difficulties and disputes in court if you separate. The other way that I mentioned is tenants and tenants in common. And this is more typical for a cohabiting couple or friends. It could be a married couple also. And this is where you can enlist a solicitor's help to agree how much of the property each party owns. So, for example, if one of you is putting in a lot more money for the deposits and mortgage costs, you may decide to split the portions 75-25 or any other type of split. The agreement can be changed at a later date if one of you starts contributing at a higher level. And if you do go down the tenants in common route, it's probably a good idea to have a cohabitation agreement or a declaration of trust drawn up. But usually, if you're married or in a civil partnership, the rules are theoretically quite straightforward. When you break up, in terms of how your assets will be divided, but of course, rarely a simple process in practice.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe that's where Shupali, you can come in and just add to that. So it sounds like from what Daniel's saying, there's two different ways of owning a property. One where you can specify the share that you own and another where it's assumed it's a 50-50. So let's say that a couple in each of those scenarios are divorcing. Is it as straightforward as Daniel has laid out when it comes to separating property on divorce?
Yeah, unfortunately not. So on divorce, there's no defined formula, and each case will depend on sort of individual circumstances. And I think the biggest consideration is the welfare of the children and making sure that they're adequately housed and that their needs are adequately met. So in terms of a wider approach, there's sort of a 50-50 starting point, and then a reason to depart from that 50-50 starting point is because one of your needs outweighs the other. So in most circumstances, it doesn't matter how the property is held, or in fact whether the property is held in one person's name as against the others.
Okay, yeah, because we get that a lot, don't we? So I often have people ring up and say, oh, we haven't got anything to sort out because the property's all in my name. And that's not necessarily when it comes to divorce, particularly in a long marriage, the case, is it? Even if the property is owned by one person, the other person may have a claim or a right to that part of that property just the same. That's right, isn't it, Shripali?
Yeah, absolutely. And the length of marriage has a lot to do with that. So there are circumstances where if it's a very short marriage and there are no children involved, then there may be an argument to sort of say that, well, because these assets were pre-acquired, there's less reason to approach it from that 50-50 sort of general point of view. Whereas if it is a long marriage and there are children involved, then essentially everything gets put into the pot, and then you start looking at it from a needs point of view.
So although, as Daniel says, in theory, you can specify the percentage of the property that you own, in practice, when you get divorced, that might not be the case.
That's absolutely correct. And as long as where there are young children involved, as long as their needs are adequately met, that's certainly a reason to pull away and depart from the whole contributions argument.
As you know very well, Kate, most divorcing couples can't afford to go to court, And even if they could, they wouldn't have enough money to allow each of them to get a fair share. So I think the real challenge is to find a cheap and cheerful formula that can work for ordinary people, put that into an app that anyone can use, while at the same time working out what's fair for the wealthy couples who can afford to go to court.
Well, that's the distinction, isn't it? There's a big difference between these principles being decided for people who are not in a needs bracket and the people who are in the needs bracket, because as David mentioned right at the beginning, a needs case trumps everything. So even if we had this formula, if ultimately most of the people coming through are a needs case, which is where there's not enough money for everybody to just divide into and everybody's housed, everybody's got enough money to live on day to day, and everyone's got enough money in retirement, because they're the kind of basics, aren't they, that we need to cover. So if most people fall into the needs bracket, will any of this Law Commission review actually have an impact on most normal people?
David,
or will the needs principles still be the same?
I'm very happy to answer that. I very much hope so. I do a lot of international work, and I'm proud of our English family justice system. It's got its faults, many faults, but I'm proud of it because it does give effect to the sacrifices and commitments people make to marriage. Giving up work for maybe 10, 15, 20 years as a judge, I hear people saying, but I haven't worked as a medical secretary or as a teacher or whatever, and technology has changed or everything has changed. Going back into the workplace after marriage is very difficult. Many people move countries either together or one may move for the other, giving up a huge amount. And the idea that we divide 50-50, Kate, the title of this podcast is 50-50 Fair, is really quite attractive. Mm. It's lovely for sort of nerds like me who can sort of get a little calculator out. And we family lawyers are very good at dividing by two, not much else, but dividing by two. But dividing by two doesn't produce fairness in the majority of the medium, modest, even lower big money cases, because it doesn't reflect the sacrifices and commitments. But that's where the reform process may well go, because it is ostensibly easy. We are surrounded in England and Wales. Wales is part of England for these purposes, by Scotland, continental Europe, all of whom would say, well, 50-50, with maybe a little bit added on, French court, equitable distribution, whatever phrase you want to use, fairness. And this seems to me, as Joshua was saying, the real heart of our problem. How do we have a law that can work out the weight we give to this commitment without derogating, taking away from marriage in any way, the commitment that people take to marriage? Because I've heard it said by people saying, well, if I'm going to divide 50-50, why should I give up my career? Why should I move countries? Why should I give up my accommodation? Mm. We'll spend my accommodation on nice holidays and we'll live in your property. And then at the end of it, it's still one person's property. This is the challenge for us. And frankly, I don't think the Law Commission should be making any proposals until we've listened.
I really hope you've enjoyed this montage of the Divorce Podcast. Don't forget, you can find me on X. I'm @Kate_Daly. You can hear more about new podcast episodes by following @Divorce_Podcast. You can also find more episodes of the podcast and subscribe for updates by visiting thedivorcepodcast.com. I just want to say a really big thank you to everyone for listening, and please keep sharing the Divorce Podcast with friends and family.